No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
Hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am Esti Dinur, and today we are doing our annual check-in with the World Watch Institute and their annual report, Vital Signs. This year it's volume 20. It's titled Pig Production from a Planet in Distress. And our guest today, as in years past, is Michael Renner, a senior researcher at the World Watch Institute. And hello, Michael. Thanks for joining us again.
Hello, Esti. Thank you very much for having me, and good to be in your program again.
Thank you. What are the most critical concerns globally currently?
Well, you know, I think the title that you mentioned that we use in our overview piece for the book, Pig Production from a Planet in Distress, sort of sums up this strange situation that we find ourselves in. You know, on one hand, when you look at a range of indicators, you know, the production of anything from, from energy to automobiles to metals to dairy products, almost anything you can name, you know, these indicators continue to point upwards, right? So there is more and more of that being produced, and we only saw sort of a very brief kind of hiccup when the economic crisis, financial and economic crisis, hit first in 2008, 2009. But it's really just sort of like a temporary break in that upward trend, and then it resumed right away again. You contrast that with a sense that, you know, a lot of the underlying systems that we rely on, you know, ecosystems, the climate system, there's more and more stress on them, of course, because we are squeezing more and more out of the planet, as it were. But it is a very contradictory situation, because you look at one set of indicators and you say to yourself, you know, this can't go on for much longer. And yet, it seems like we somehow managed to do that. And I think what it comes down to is that, you know, the decision makers, I think, more often are drawn to the indicators that tell us, hey, we're doing more of this. You know, we're doing okay. You know, we're keeping up. And I think there is less attention being given typically to the underlying issues that, you know, tell us that, you know, we have to find different ways of living on this planet.
So that's I think one of the main issues. Is it seems like a lot of us understand what's going on, and I'm sure so do the CEOs of corporations and the heads of government, and yet it seems like we're not able to start thinking in a different way. How can that happen? How can we actually start changing things in a systematic and significant way?
Well, you know, that is the key question. I think anybody who can figure out how to make us, you know, change our ways, I think deserves all the prizes there are in this world, it would seem. Because, you know, we have had, of course, a number of efforts, and we have ongoing efforts to, you know, to change the decision making that underlies where we're going, where we're headed. You know, there has been for many, many years, as you know, and I'm sure as your listeners know, you know, there have been efforts by the environmental community to say, you know, we have to change the price signals. You know, we have to tell the markets what's really going on. You know, prices should tell the truth. You know, we have to have a price on carbon and all kinds of, you know, pollutants and so on. And, you know, I still think that, of course, at a certain level, all of that makes sense. But where we have done this, to some extent, we haven't done it sort of wholeheartedly. You know, we have done it only a little bit. And I think that really has not translated well enough into saying, okay, we really have to change the actual actions, the actual policies, right? I mean, think, for example, of in the context of the European Union, they have had for a number of years a so-called cap-and-trade system for carbon emissions. But the way it's been set up is, you know, it is so weak, and it is so full of loopholes and exceptions and so on, that the carbon price that actually is being produced by this system has collapsed, right? It is so cheap, it really does not make a difference. So, it seems like we've made some of these kinds of attempts, but we haven't made them nearly enough, nearly to the degree that is actually needed. And so it's a very strange situation, you know, because you could almost say, oh, well, we've tried this and we've failed. But I think the real message is we haven't tried nearly hard enough. And, you know, we have to not just think of change in sort of very technical terms, as it were, but I think we really have to think of change in the way of how do we live? What's the underlying culture that we bring to this?
Mm-hmm. Well, and actually you give at least two other examples in the book of things like that, one is the carbon capture and storage, which is supposedly a good trend, but actually it may really just be another way to stay away from alternatives to the kind of ways we currently extract and use energy.
I think that's right. I mean, clearly carbon capture is, I mean, to begin with, it's a fairly controversial topic and probably will remain so. In theory, you know, this is something quite interesting because you could say, well, you know, if we can actually capture the carbon, then, you know, maybe there isn't a real problem with using fossil fuels, or at least using them, you know, at a relatively high level still, even if we continue to expand on renewable energy and energy efficiency and so on. But, you know, when you look at the literature that's out there, there are strong indications that the technology continues to be not really proven. There are all kinds of remaining issues, and they may not be resolved anytime soon. Even if you make some headway on that, many of the technologies that have been pursued so far actually are very energy intensive themselves, so that you actually have to use more energy in the process, right? So it's a somewhat self-defeating proposition at a certain level. And then I think the larger issue is, you know, yes, does that actually make us, you know, does that make governments and corporations and others think, you know, we don't really have to change our ways anyway. We don't really have to do more in the way of promoting renewables. We don't really have to look at, do we really need to lead such an energy-intensive lifestyle, right? I mean, I think at that level can be terribly self-defeating to think, you know, with this technology, there really ultimately is not a problem.
Mm-hmm. And one big example of how the thinking isn't changing at all is the whole issues of subsidies. Subsidies both for energy and for agriculture are actually really going against everything that needs to be done right now, don't they?
I think that's unfortunately very much true. I mean, nobody quite knows really the full extent of subsidies for fossil fuels, for example. But what we have in our book is we rely on what we think are probably about the best estimates out there, and they indicate that in 2012, fossil fuel subsidies may have ranged anywhere from $775 billion to more than $1 trillion. And that's, of course, I mean, I don't need to say this, but it's clearly a massive amount of money, and particularly if it's put in the context of saying, well, so how much do we subsidize renewable energy in comparison, where that's, and we don't have as much up-to-date figures, but that's below $70 billion a year, which is a good, you know, a good figure, certainly, but again, it pales in comparison with what we continue to spend on fossil fuels. And so, therefore, of course, we are, as societies, as human societies on this planet, we continue to drive ourselves in the wrong direction as a result.
Mm-hmm. I would like to get into some of the meat of the book and the information that you provide. I would also like to invite our listeners to call and join the conversation if they haven't done so in the past 7 days, 256-2001, 1-866-899-WORD, or you can make Elsie happy and contact us on social media, either at Wart Talk on Twitter or at A Public Affair on Facebook. So let's talk about some of the issues that that the book deals with quite extensively. We already talked about global oil consumption, but let's give the details. Just how much is it increasing? Where is it increasing? Why is it increasing? And what does the near future look like?
Well, with regard to oil consumption, we do see continued growth. It's in recent years not been quite as strong as, you know, as some earlier years, and of course that is a reflection to some extent of the economic and financial crisis. But this hiccup that I had mentioned earlier, which certainly can be seen in the oil markets as well, was something that was really overcome fairly quickly. And while there is less or relatively steady consumption in the Western countries, in the rest of the world, China and the developing countries, I mean, they are catching up increasingly. And of course, from a Western perspective, it's hard to say, we had a good run with fossil fuels, but don't you think of doing the same thing as we? I mean, there is that interesting connection, of course, where those who have benefited from the use of oil and other fossil fuels for so long really at a certain level need to take the initiative to say there are other ways to run a society, to run an economy, without causing so much destruction to the natural world.
Mm-hmm. And the use of coal has been increasing. Is that correct?
The use of coal is increasing. It's I think if I remember this correctly offhand, at the highest level that it's been in almost 30 years. So for a while its role had actually declined in relative terms, but it really is sort of coming back with a vengeance, as it were. And of course, partly, as we were talking about just a minute ago, it's partly driven by the sense, that there is such a notion as clean coal, right? I mean, this is, mm-hmm. to me, this is a prime example of the kind of sort of self-defeating ideology that's out there, right? If we only label things the right way, if we only say there is a technology that will help us, to continue with the old ways, then it's okay. I think these kinds of things are very much in evidence. Now, of course, it needs to be said that, China is at this point the major the major culprit, as it were, the major user of coal. It continues to expand its coal use. At the same time, as it is also the major driver of expansion of renewable energy. So there is a very contradictory kind of situation that's unfolding.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think many of us have seen the photos of Beijing under such pollution that you can't actually see anything on the street. Is that thanks to coal?
Oh, it very much is thanks to coal, so to speak, yes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, it's an important aspect, I think, to keep in mind, because it's all too easy, I think, when one talks about, say, climate change, right, to come across as, just talking in sort of fairly abstract ways, right, in terms of, what does climate science tell us, what happens globally to, global average temperature and so on. And it's very hard, I think, for most people to say, well, so what does that really mean for me? I lead my life in one particular place. For me, what I see changing perhaps is the weather. It's not, I can't tell whether this is climate related or not. And so I think for people to be able to make that connection, it has to be brought down to a level that actually makes sense to one's daily experience, right? And so I think air pollution is definitely one of the factors that, where you can say, well, that is one very direct consequence, even let alone what happens on the climate level.
Mm-hmm. So I would like to talk about such experience that I have just experienced and that is discussed actually in the book, water scarcity. So I mentioned last week that I had spent 2 weeks in Northern California, which is a beautiful part of the country and the world, Redwood Country, and the whole area is still very green, and I suppose that's because, as I learned, redwoods have roots that are as tall, down as the tree is up, and there's a lot of evergreens there too. But as it happens, the area has been seeing a drought for 5-6 years now, and it's very interesting to watch how people are dealing with that, because people, there's a lot of homesteaders there, and people draw water from the, like in one case that I saw, drawing water from a trout stream that is on their property, even as they understand that doing that is basically killing the trout stream from which they get trout, and also eventually the lake that it goes into, which has been going down something like 20 feet. And I met a guy who had just bought water skis and spent a whole day driving them around until he finally found a place where he could run them, because everything is so way down, and that specific lake was just 20 feet down and not 40 as others. There are signs as you drive around that say Farmers Feed America, and that's because these farmers are drawing this water that is making the water level go down so much. But of course, without water, there won't be agriculture, which indeed feeds America. You see irrigation canals that take just tremendous amounts of water. And so you really see how, in a situation like that, to survive, you have to do things that you know will make it so that you won't be able to survive in a few years. And so that was my personal experience that really made me think about this whole issue of water scarcity. Talk about that, if you will, in a global context.
Well, I think what you see in parts of the United States is certainly very much true in other parts of the world. Not everywhere, clearly, but in significant parts of the world. I mean, if you look at, just take one example, if you look at South Asia, you have pretty much the same situation where farmers are drawing very, very heavily on water and at rates that clearly are not sustainable. I mean, it is known now that, you know, the water table in considerable parts of India and Pakistan, for example, are declining. And, you know, yet this situation continues in part because there are subsidies in place that make it appear to the individual farmer that this can go on at least for some time. So I think these, you know, these kinds of issues, these kinds of problems definitely come together in a place like that. It's not really, you know, it's not clear what ultimately will change the situation in many of these places, because, I mean, the subsidies are very difficult to change or to get rid of. You know, they are, of course, politically very popular, and any government trying to make a change makes itself very unpopular. There's no question about it. I mean, here's sort of, right, I mean, this is sort of the politics of the moment, as right. opposed to a sort of a politics of longer-term thinking, which very often is what loses out. But then also, as you indicated, you know, people need to somehow make things work for themselves as they move along, right? I mean, you have to be able to eat and drink and live today. You can't say, well, I'll live, you know, next month or next year. So there is, I think, there is this very strange situation that we face that militates against more of a long-term approach to things and more of a long-term way of thinking. And that's the case in many, many places. You know, if you look at, I mean, one thing that strikes me is, if you look at what happened, for example, in parts of Syria, which of course now has been suffering from a civil war, a mm-hmm. terrible civil war. One of the reasons actually why there was growing dissatisfaction, I mean, certainly, let me emphasize, not the only reason by any means, but one of many reasons why there was growing dissatisfaction with the government was this incredible problem with water scarcity, with tremendous declines in agricultural yields, where, you know, tens of thousands of people basically had to abandon their fields, had to migrate into cities, and became, you know, sort of, in a sense, like internal refugees of a sort. And that reinforced, you know, this broader, you know, political dissatisfaction, of course, in the country that arose from a very non-representative authoritarian government. And so while I think the consequence that we have seen play out in Syria is probably not one that we'll see play out in many other countries, certainly. I think it does give us an indication that, you know, there may be consequences down the line that will be very, very hard to deal with. And as difficult as it is now to say, you know, we can't go on as we are, that seems the lesser challenge compared with when things really get out of hand, when things get really, really go bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and you talk about Syria, and it made me think a lot of people there in Northern California have guns, and, you know, some of them have arsenals, and I don't see it as impossible to think that at some point there will be water wars there, definitely throughout the Middle East, etc. So what would long-term thinking about water scarcity look like, and is something like that implemented anywhere in the world at this point?
Well, you know, I think the good news in a lot of these with a lot of these issues is there are options that are available to us. There are options, right? I mean, I already mentioned on the energy side, you know, renewable energy, energy efficiency, and so on. And we have really only scratched the surface on many of these. But the same is true with regard to water use in agriculture. You know, if you look at many countries around the world, the way in which water is used, it is highly inefficient, right? I mean, you have unlined canals where a lot of the water gets lost on the way even to the field, where water evaporates, you know, where too much water is applied, and you actually get water logging, which is a separate kind of problem. Mm. You actually, if there were a serious effort to say, let's pursue water efficiency, I mean, it could work wonders in many ways. And if you look at, for example, the experience in Israel, I mean, their highly water efficient technology has been developed and is being used, and clearly it's being shown that that's, you know, technically possible. Mm-hmm. Or you look at, you know, there is now a slowly growing phenomenon, again, in parts of South Asia, but also other parts of the world, the so-called system of rice intensification, which involves different techniques that actually allow you to use a lot less water than is the case conventionally, and at the same time actually increase your yields. But I think, you know, often the problem is not technological. The problem is sort of social, economic, and political, right? I mean, do we have the right ways of organizing things in society to get this done? You know, are there, and I think often that's the case, you know, are there forces who really just have no interest in seeing substantial change, right, because the current situation works out well enough for them? So I think those are more often, I think, the questions that need to be asked than, you know, is it technologically possible to do this differently, to do this more efficiently?
Yeah. My guest is Michael Renner, who is a senior researcher at World Watch Institute, and we're talking about this year's Vital Signs, the 20th volume. And let's take the first caller for you, Michael. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hello, is that
yes,
me?
Yes, it is.
My question is regarding conservation and how we can emphasize that. I mean, I think it seems like we have the technology for that. We just aren't applying it. And also how you think locally people can move toward that. I live rurally in Dane County, or more or less rurally, and I was just astounded to know that they pump all the sewage from the whole county here to the our sewage treatment plant, which I don't think is wrong, but it seems to me an awful lot of, if we could conserve water, we wouldn't be pumping as much sewage, and also we're pumping water up and pumping it back, and both seem just ridiculous to me.
Mm-hmm.
I can't understand how that can be that efficient.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not an expert in this particular field, but my sense is that most, you know, by far most of the water use is in agriculture, and I think, you know, I think of the efficiency measures need to happen there. Quantity wise, you know, many other uses are much, much smaller. I mean, not to say we shouldn't worry about it, but I think, you know, that will not make as much of a difference, positive or negative, as what we do with regard to what's happening in agricultural fields. I mean, there, and clearly this is of concern to all of us because, you know, if we continue to use too much water, then at some point, you know, we will have a problem maintaining this system that we have, and we will have problems with regard to food production. So that I think is, you know, is certainly the key concern here.
Mm-hmm. So back to the report, Michael, added to the growing scarcity of water and other resources is the fact that the population continues growing, isn't it?
That's correct. And, you know, interestingly, the most recent data from the United Nations, and our book actually did not reflect that because they came out after the book appeared. But they actually do, you know, once more indicate that some of the earlier optimism, you know, about sort of a more natural decline in overall population size, that was probably a bit misplaced. I mean, there's still, when you look at the different scenarios, you know, there is an enormously broad range of estimates of how, you know, population may evolve globally over the next few decades. But I think what it certainly indicates is that, you know, this is certainly something that hasn't been fully resolved. Now, I think what I would want to add here is that, you know, what's interesting to me is for many, many years, you know, people concerned about population were talking about, you know, sort of the overall numbers, you know, the gross numbers, and sort of just emphasizing that there's just too many people. To me, that has always been problematic in a number of ways. First of all, I mean, you need to, of course, look much more in detail in different regions and in different countries. What is the exact situation? Is there, you know, a lot of population pressure on existing resources? Is there not? You know, then there are issues of equity. You know, is a small part of the population actually really claiming most of the resources anyway? But what really is worthy of more and more attention, and it has gotten more attention at least, is, you know, the role of women, right? The rights of women, because for too long, I think women were just regarded as, well, sort of birthing machines, to put it in a very crass way, mm-hmm. right? And I think making sure that women have, you know, much greater rights, equal rights with men, probably is the most important thing you can do to change the dynamics, the underlying dynamics in countries where birth rates are still very high. Because typically, you know, anytime women have a chance to say what they really prefer, you know, they will say, I don't want to have that many children. You know, I want a smaller family. You know, I want a family that I can manage, right? That I can handle. And so I think on the rights level, I think this becomes a very different issue. It's no longer just about, you know, overall numbers, but it is about, it's about specific human beings. It's about rights. It's about how do we relate to each other. And so I think it's good because it connects up with different concerns that are much more real to people in their daily lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, so continuing with this line, of course, people here in the West cost the world, the Earth, the planet, a lot more than do people in much poorer areas of the world, and yet it seems like one of the biggest issues nowadays is to make sure women cannot have abortion, and also the curbing of family planning, and that curbing goes global too, because the United States, of course, gives money to a lot of the poor parts of the world, but there's less and less that goes to things like family planning. So, again, we're seeing this political jousting that is so contrary to what should be done. Is that correct?
I would agree with you, absolutely. I mean, I should point out that this is a particular topic that's not in this year's Climate
right.
Science book. We have certainly talked about, you know, related issues in earlier editions. And, you know, each year, I mean, I don't know, your readers, your listeners, rather, may or may not notice, every year this book that we're putting out has a range of topics, and it's not always exactly the same from year to year. So we
right.
will address, you know, a topic of one year, but perhaps not the next. But I think you, again, I I think you're right. And looking at some of the trends here in the United States, I think it's quite worrisome to see how rights that have long been established are now being undermined and are being curtailed. I mean, that's a thing of considerable concern, both domestically for women in the U.S., but I think also, as you rightly pointed out, for you know, any programs that that provide funding for programs internationally.
Mm-hmm. But what you do write about in this volume is about women farmers. Talk about that, if you will.
Yes, I mean, that is one aspect that you know, seemed worth highlighting. And you know, again, there too, there is an interesting aspect that many women are involved in farming, but their their ability to control their own livelihoods, their, you know, how well they fare, these are often very curtailed because they don't have the formal right to the land, and they're often just seen as, you know, not their own masters, basically, right? So there's an enormous gap that that is in place in many countries, and I would think too, and I think if I remember correctly, that the piece itself does point out that in situations where women farmers have greater rights, have better access to land, to resources, to, you know, extension services, all these kinds of things, they are, and this is not terribly surprising, they are far more productive. They do far better. Right? So again, it would of course make sense to say, well, yes, let's create greater equality. But clearly, there are many, you know, cultural and political obstacles in the way to doing that, and this I think is a continued, you know, an area that needs continued attention to at least create some movement forward, some progress.
Mm-hmm. 256-2001, 1-866-899 WORT at War Talk, or A Public Affair on Facebook. You know, Michael, I think if we talk about cars, we will get some callers. That seems to get you do have there is a piece there about automobile production. Tell us what we know about that.
Well, you know, as I was saying earlier about other indicators, I mean, this is clearly one where the trends are pointing really skyward. And again, you know, just 1 to 2 years ago, you know, the situation in the auto industry was one of tremendous crisis, of gloom, of, you know, not knowing at all what the future would hold. You know, production declined tremendously for a short while. Of course, sales did, clearly related to the economic crisis. But since then, the industry has picked up with, you know, and come back with a vengeance. I mean, it's incredible when you look at some of the trends, and we now see that if you look at both passenger cars and also so-called light passenger vehicles, so including SUVs and so on, the numbers have now passed 80 million units per year worldwide in terms of production, and that's much, much higher than it has ever been. Mm-hmm. So clearly, we are continue to go in a direction that ultimately is not sustainable, because as long as we have cars that rely on gasoline, on fossil fuels, we are just putting more pressure on the existing systems. Now, you know, there is of course, you know, I'm sure somebody will right away say, but wait a minute, you know, we are making progress with regard to fuel efficiency. That's true up to a point. I don't think we make nearly as much progress as we probably should. But yes, there is some progress. And then I think the other point that could be made is to say, but we now see new trends emerging in terms of, you know, hybrid vehicles, electric vehicles. And again, that is true. But it also should be added that for the time being, these are still very, very minor factors. Overall, worldwide, I think, if you count everything that's alternative, you know, alternative propulsion systems for automobiles, it amounts perhaps to about 2-3% of global production. So we have, if anything, a long, long way to go. And let me just, I mean, I don't want to just go on and on and on, but let me add one more thought. Electric vehicles may help us resolve certain challenges. But of course, as long as we have an electricity generation system that still very heavily relies on coal, we really are just shifting the nature of the problem around, right? We may no longer have so much of a local pollution issue, but we really are not doing much better with regard to the factors that contribute to climate change.
Right, and to add to that, at least from what I heard, the battery of the Prius, for example, is incredibly toxic and made of some rare earth things. And so that really makes you think about just how much better the Prius is. But I also was thinking, you know, it's possible that we're getting very few calls today because everybody is at the Capitol protesting against our Governor Walker, who has been, his police have been arresting people right and left in the past couple of days. But it's relevant to mention him right now because there was a subsidy for a light rail for Wisconsin, $810 million worth of money for that, and he refused to take it while he's giving more and more money for road building. So here again, another example of that thinking that is taking us down, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. It's certainly unfortunate in my view, and we have, of course, seen that in some other states play out as well. It's very unfortunate, I think, because if you don't start at some point, of course, later on, the problem will only become bigger, and one does have to wonder, you know, do people ultimately really enjoy their automobiles so much that they like to sit in traffic jams, right? I mean, that's of course what is one of the most immediate situations that people face, right? I mean, they may not so much be concerned. I mean, the individual person who is driving a car is not going to think, oh, I'm adding to climate change or I'm adding to air pollution, but rather, will I get from, you know, from my origin to my destination in the amount of time that I think it should take, right? Or will I be caught once more in traffic? And even at that level, I mean, if you look around the country, you know, the amount of time and the amount of gasoline that gets wasted in traffic tie-ups is tremendous. And it's true, not just, of course, here in the United States, but elsewhere. And, you know, even in some other countries, the situation is I would say deplorable. I was born myself in Germany, and I was just reading the other day that the government there decided, like Governor Walker in Wisconsin, to invest more money in road building and highway building, and to actually reduce the amount of money that's available for railroad building. Track building, or you know, providing proper maintenance, and there have been quite some issues there. But you look at a country like neighboring France, where you know there has been at least some degree of rethinking, and there is a willingness to actually shift the priority from road building to railways. And so it's a mixed picture when we look all around the world. You know, you look, for example, again at China. As much as car crazy as this country has become, they have also made major investments in their railways, both for freight purposes and passenger purposes. So we see really, I think, a mix of certainly not so good news, but also some encouraging news. And I always like to be, at some point at least, somewhat optimistic. And so in those moments, I turn to those kinds of more encouraging elements that we do see out there.
Right. And we'll get to your positive trends, too, after we talk to our next caller here. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hi. I wonder if you could speak to the so-called climate deniers, the people that are hired by the fossil fuel industries to get on the public airways wherever they are and to fund ALEC and send the letters to all legislatures telling them climate change is not a problem and never will be a problem. And then the public is they run commercials. There's a lot of people out there lying through their teeth, and it's hard to get the public to take this issue seriously when you got that kind of money being thrown at not telling them the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Thank you, Michael.
Yes, I wanted to thank the caller as well. I think you're quite right. And, of course, we know by now that there are some very deep-pocketed people who have no scruple in terms of what they're doing, what they're funding. And there is no let-up, no end in sight in terms of sort of this disinformation that's going on. And I quite agree. I mean, anytime one looks, you said, writing letters and what's on the airwaves, but also, of course, also online, if you look on many websites, anytime there's a discussion that relates to climate or environmental issues, you almost automatically have a whole bevy of people that chime in with all kinds of misleading claims. And it is very hard to rise above this noise and to say, well, so what is really true, right? Because, I mean, most of us, and that includes me, we're not climate scientists, right? We have to rely on those who know the science and decide on the basis of what we read, what we hear, what we learn, what is to be believed. And clearly, there are parts of the population that are so exposed to the distortions and the outright lies that they will take a different view on it. It's very deplorable, and I don't think anybody really has a good way of, dealing with the situation. Otherwise, I'm sure you would have seen more of it. I mean, there's the only way, I think, the only way forward is to keep repeating certain insights from climate science and make it as simple, I want to say, this may not be quite the right word, I mean, as understandable, as accessible as possible, because any of us reading, climate science papers, we will, I would assume, not understand most of what we read because it is so complicated and it's so technical. But I think there's a need to not just make climate science more understandable to, ordinary people, but I think also to do a better job at relating it to their own experience day to day. And you would think, that, with more and more, disasters happening, more and more frequently, that there is an easier way for more people to understand, this is real, this is not theoretical, this is not some scam that some scientists are trying to pull, but this is real, and we can more and more see it in our own daily lives, almost every day, I want to say. I mean, to just give you an example, and of course there's always, one always has to say, it's really hard to link a single event to a changed climate, but it is the accumulation of more and more extreme events that pile up more and more often that I think help make the point. But to just give you an example, I mean, I'm sitting outside of New York City on Long Island, and we had, 1 week ago, we had a temperature that fell about like 109 degrees. Today, we are in the low 60s and you're freezing. Right? So this is more and more what more and more of us experience. And I think it is evidence of, a part of climate change that perhaps often doesn't get across, but the variability, the unpredictability that's part of what's happening more and more. It's not we used to refer to this as global warming, and people would say, oh, well, but, it's not as warm as it was the other day. But I think the real truth is it is not a steady development. It's not a matter of it just, steadily getting warmer and warmer and warmer, although over time that is what happens. But in the human experience, day to day, week to week, month to month, it is these incredible changes, these extreme changes. You could one day you could have absolutely, downpours of rain. The next day you have drought conditions, right? And this is the new normal. This is, I think, what we have to understand what is involved.
Right, and it's the same here. A week and a half ago, so it was just incredibly hot here, and now it is in the 60s. In Northern California, it got to 111, which was a record since they started keeping records, and it broke the record of 108, which was 2 years ago, but they've never known these sorts of temperatures before. But let's, I just want to mention a few of the other things that are discussed in the book before we go to some positive signs and some hopeful notes. So we didn't talk about the rising unemployment and what you call vulnerable employment, the divide between rich and poor, and the consequences of that for huge numbers of people and for the planet herself, natural disasters. We just talked about a little bit here. Metals production recovers, as you put it in the book, which is not good news. Climate change, migration, urbanization, but let's talk about some of the positive trends that you found. So one of them is improvement in sanitation and access to water for as many as 227 million people. That really does sound like some good news.
That is certainly in the news, a good news category, no question about it. And you know, often these are the kinds of things that we, you know, say in the newspaper or wherever we get our news from, that we don't read about, because a lot of this happens in sort of a very quiet manner. You know, it's often done by either by small NGOs or by UN agencies or others that, you know, work very quietly, right? I mean, it's not something that's, how should I say, I mean, it's typically not an exciting topic. And yet for people in poor developing countries, it really is the difference between life and death. So there definitely is a very good trend there. And, you know, there are others like it. I mean, other things we pick up on in our book this year is, for example, we found that there are growing numbers of people who are organized in all kinds of cooperatives, economic cooperatives, right, whether they be consumer cooperatives, producer cooperatives, you know, financial cooperatives. So that, too, I think is very encouraging, very good news.
Do you want to explain how does that matter in the context of the environment and health of the planet? Why does it matter if people are organized in cooperatives or are just consumers?
Well, you know, I feel strongly that while we at World Watch believe that, you know, governments and corporations need to act differently, you know, I think it is very important to give people a much stronger stake in their lives, you know, mm-hmm. to give them the ability to make decisions that, at least for parts of their life experience, you know, have you know, hold great importance. And, you know, many of us, of course, I mean, typically the situation is, you know, we are dependently employed, if we are employed at all, right? And so there are many decisions in our daily lives that are not truly in our hands. Now, if you're a member of a cooperative, it gives you a certain wherewithal, up to a point, right? It gives you an ability to act, you know, more independently than otherwise might be the case. So in that context, we regard that as a positive development.
Mm-hmm. And you also saw some positive developments in the ways of efficient irrigation in some parts of the world. And you're talking about organic agriculture and why that is beneficial, not just to human health, but for the health of the planet again.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's so many positive impacts. I mean, in terms of, you know, reducing clearly the use of fossil fuel, but often it also really means, again, and this is something I've been saying a number of times, you know, what it means for people on the ground, right? Say people who are, you know, farmers or laborers in fields, they, you know, with regard to organic farming, they handle far less or perhaps none of very dangerous materials, you know, like pesticides, for example, right? I mean, in India, there has been a tremendous problem, you know, the pesticide poisonings that have taken place. So there are benefits that I think both apply sort of at a broad systemic level, but also at the level where people can actually see a difference in their own lives. And I think that connection really is, I mean, I keep repeating this, but that is so essential, because people need to see a benefit for themselves, you know, that they can experience in their own lives, because otherwise it will remain abstract to them and they will not care nearly as much about it.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of benefits, you also mentioned benefit corporations. What are these?
Well, this is a sort of a new form of a corporation that has emerged initially, I think, out of Maryland. And what it basically gets down to is that the rules by which such a corporation lives are not just oriented toward, you know, the highest value for shareholders, but bringing into the mix considerations like, you know, is what we're doing sustainable? You know, is it, does it have benefit to local surrounding communities with which we are doing business or to which we are neighbors? So that a broader, you know, a broader range of considerations comes into play when the officers and directors of a corporation say, well, where do we invest? How do we invest? You know, what do we take into account in terms of saying this was a, you know, a positive, a successful investment, or no, this is something that didn't work out for us.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's something that really just very slowly is emerging. You know, there's still fairly limited numbers of such companies, but it is picking up more and more interest, I think, around the country, and there are even some examples in other countries now where, you know, where people are saying, so what's been your experience? You know, what are some of the insights, the lessons learned? How can we make this work? And it's something that I suspect will take clearly a good number of years before it becomes more, you know, enters more the mainstream, where it will become something that people will say, yes, I know about that. You know, I've made some experience with this, or I know this and this company operates by these principles. So as with any alternative, it's at first very slow going, you know, to establish itself, to become a credible, workable alternative. But I think it's something that's, you know, has a real future.
Mm-hmm. And how do we know to distinguish them from everybody else that says they are green, but really they're just greenwashing, or corporations like Nike and Google, which, you know, tell us that they're good and they care and all that, but when you actually look into it, you find that they're not. Is there a way to really know that the corporation is what you call a benefit corporation?
Yes, there is. I mean, there is a different legal form. You know, I mean, you actually have to adopt something that is not just where you don't just run an advertising campaign and say, yes, as you just indicated, you know, well, you're green now. But rather where you have to hold fast to certain principles and you have to meet certain tests. So it is something that actually can be monitored up to a point and can be either proven or disproven, as it were. So, yes, I mean, there are ways to make sure that this is not just something that sounds good but may not really make a difference on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you mentioned also that wind energy has been increasing, and that, of course, is good news. We have about a minute and a half, and I guess I would like you to end with whatever you think is the most important thing or two for our listeners to take away with them.
That's a challenging question, but I would think that, you know, let me maybe just tell you what I often sort of feel and honestly struggle with. You know, many, as this conversation that we have been having has indicated, many of the trends that are out there are very challenging, no question about it. But, you know, as the latter part of our conversation also showed, there are really still lots of good options out there. Many of these options are becoming slowly more prominent, are growing, you know, are expanding, are becoming more visible. And ultimately, I think that's really the takeaway message, that, you know, we still have many, many options if we decide to act. You know, we're certainly not at the point where we say, well, you know, we ran this old model so far, we have run out of options. That, I think, is still very far from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to get our act together. You know, we have to understand that we need to act on these options to make them real, to scale them up, to replicate them elsewhere. And I think, you know, we need to keep thinking in positive terms, because otherwise, of course, people will say, you know, now we have to just make the best out of a bad situation, and what else is there to do?
Well, mm-hmm.
I'd rather not think about it, right? That's often the conclusion.
Yes. Well, Michael Renner, senior researcher at the World Watch Institute, and one of the editors, I believe, of Vital Signs, Volume 20, Peak Production from A Planet in Distress. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thanks, Steve, for having me again.
Yes, bye-bye. We'll have you again next year.